This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. This week, we're going to be talking about some of the new movies that are in theaters, including Pan, Drunk Stone Brilliant Dead, and Peace Officer. I'll also have the news, the trailer park, and of course, the world-famous DVD Roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies, or you can reach out to me on Twitter at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
That's right. It's time for the news, and I'm going to kick into something that I normally don't do, and I talked about it a couple weeks ago, and that is TV. But in particular, it's geek TV. It's Doctor Who, because this is the most important thing that's happening in the world right now. What's happening with Doctor Who? Everything else is secondary, because Doctor Who is a legend. They just started the ninth season of the revamped Doctor Who with, of course, the 12th Doctor, played by Peter Capaldi. And one of the big changes they made this season is he got rid of his sonic screwdriver. He's got sonic sunglasses. Now, Stephen Moffat, the showrunner, has come out and said, well, you have to be heretical sometimes and give into the heresy, and basically said, well, it's just a screwdriver that makes noise, so let's ditch it and get a different thing. So he gets these glasses. But I have to say that as dorky as the sonic screwdriver was, especially early in its existence back in the 70s, changing it to sunglasses is one of the dumbest things I've ever seen. It is the equivalent of a music supervisor in a cartoon during the 80s who was like, I got an idea. Let's change the theme song to a rap. And then you get the whitest, dumbest rap you've ever gotten, like the Dragnet rap that's done by Tom Hanks and Dan Aykroyd from the film version of Dragnet, which is embarrassing. Look it up on YouTube sometime. It is unbelievable that Oscar winner Tom Hanks made this music video. I understand that Doctor Who is fantasy and it's geek science fiction, and only nerds like me really care about this stuff. But the thing that was such genius about recent Doctor Who elements is, in particular, the 10th and the 11th Doctor, Matt Smith. One thing that Matt Smith did as the 11th Doctor, he was a total nerd. But he just declared things to be cool, like bow ties and suspenders and fezzes. And that made them cool because he didn't care. And it's the attitude that he has. I wear a bow tie. Bow ties are cool. And then bow ties kind of become cool because of that. The reason this is different is because you're taking something that actually is cool, Ray-Ban sunglasses, and you're giving them to the Doctor to try and make the Doctor more cool, which is dumb. Now, with that said, I like the new season. And of course, I think the sonic screwdriver is going to be back. It actually once left in the series, so the 5th Doctor got rid of it because they were finding it to be too much of an easy plot device. It always ends up saving the day, which it does now. But they got rid of it with the 5th Doctor, and it didn't come back until he rebooted the series. But so they're going to be featuring a toy set coming up at Christmas that apparently has the sonic screwdriver in it, so it may not have gone forever. This is important stuff, people. This is the thing that makes the world go round. All the other things are secondary. Politics, economy, the sonic screwdriver and sonic sunglasses, that's where it's at. Another piece of news I want to hit on is, just to reinforce something that I said for a while, Meryl Streep's an idiot. And here's why. I mean, I know there's a lot of people who Meryl Streep can do no wrong and they think she's wonderful. I don't. I think she blows hot and cold in movies. I think she's only good when she's actually directed rather than just kind of left to her own devices. But she went on apparently a tear this week and attacked Rotten Tomatoes in specifics, but film criticism in general, of which I'm part. And here's the quote. She goes, I went deep, 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 deep. Of those allowed to rate on the tomato meter, there are 168 women. And I thought, that's absolutely fantastic. If there are 168 men, it would be balanced. Dot, dot, dot. Actually, there are 760 men who weigh in on the tomato meter. And she continues to say, the word isn't disheartening. It's infuriating. I submit to you that men and women are not the same, which is true, by the way. Men and women are not the same. There's hormones and chemicals and biology that makes men and women different. You know, not to a point of inequality under the law, but let's not forget the fact that men and women are different creatures. But she said, if the tomato meter is slided so completely to one set of tastes, that drives box office in the U.S. Absolutely. Now, forget the fact that Meryl Streep has actually taken notice of me, because I'm a tomato meter critic. Maybe she's just upset that I didn't like Ricky in the Flash. But in all seriousness, joking aside, this is a great example of how things evolve in a marketplace that appear to be institutionalized sexism or racism or something else, when they really aren't. It'd be one thing if these critics represented top papers and outlets, and there was this cabal conspiring to keep only men in those positions, but that's just plain not the case. This is an independently chosen group of people. I've been on the selection committee of the Online Film Critics Society that chooses people that would be able to rank in the tomato meter. And you can only choose the critics that apply. Maybe they're just more male film critics. I know a lot of film critics, and I know a lot of female film critics. But I have to say, just in casual observation, there's more men in the field. And I don't know why. Maybe we're the ones who want to live in our parents' basement and try and make a career out of writing a blog. Who knows? But a lot of critics now get listed. They're doing it on their own. They're not employed by some major paper somewhere. This is a long time from when the Chicago Sun-Times and the Chicago Tribune ruled the marketplace on film criticism. A lot of the people who are doing film critic work, they're getting paid little or nothing sometimes, and they're maybe building their own site, but that's it. Again, there's no cabal here. There is no overall sexism in film criticism. It's not easier to get credentials as a man to be a film critic. Which I find, again, fascinating that it's Meryl Streep who's paying attention to this sort of nonsense. It's not like the film criticisms of this old boys club that it has a glass ceiling. And it's been that way for as long as I've been in it, for about 15 years. So Meryl Streep's an idiot. I mean, we're now attacking things that aren't actually a problem. They may be indicative of a problem, or they just might be the way it evolved in the marketplace. Who knows? This comes on the heel of the fact that apparently the feds are going to start looking into Hollywood being discriminatory to women because there are fewer female directors and fewer executives. Well, show me a business that isn't like that. Show me an industry. How many bankers, how many female heads of banks are there compared to men? Where's the federal investigation on that? And there's reasons for that that go beyond an old boys club trying to keep the ladies out. But Meryl Streep, thank you for paying attention to me, Meryl, but I'm sorry I have a penis. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. Two real quick ones I want to talk about. One's coming out in like 2 weeks. It's Bone Tomahawk, and it stars Kurt Russell in full-blown Hateful Eight facial hair. And it's a Western. Guys going out for revenge. Opens on October 23rd.
There's a situation. Serious.
Mrs. O'Dwyer was abducted.
She is my everything, and those savages have got her.
We're making a 5-day journey in 3 days, riding along and sleeping the bare minimum. If our horses die before we get there, or we go into hostile territory, weak and foggy with exhaustion, we won't rescue anybody.
It looks like it's a slow burn, and I give it credit because it looks like the movie's a slow burn and the trailer's a slow burn. It's going for intensity. It's not going for action. One of the things I can't stand about a lot of modern Western trailers is they give it a crazy, awesome, hip soundtrack, and it makes it look like a big rockin' action movie, and it's just the slow burn, which a lot of modern Westerns are that. Bone Tomahawk's getting a limited release. I don't know if it's going to come anywhere near me, but I'll check it out if I have a chance. The next one I want to hit on is The Good Dinosaur. Opens on November 25th. It's the next Pixar movie.
Where am I? We need to get home.
That creature protected you.
What is his name?
I'm done being scared.
If you ain't scared, you ain't alive.
I was talking to my Disney publicist the other week, and for some reason I wasn't thinking The Good Dinosaur was coming out so soon, because we just had Inside Out, and that's just because things got delayed and the schedule bumped it around. But this is a banner year for Pixar. They get two movies in the entire year. This one looks very charming. It looks very sweet. The trailer, like many Pixar trailers, really have a hard time encapsulating it into that 2 minutes, because there's so much heart and soul, and these movies tend to be pretty high concept. I'm not wild about the trailer, but I'm sure I'll love it because it's Pixar, and Pixar has yet to make a movie that I absolutely hated. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to start the reviews with Pan and Drunk Stone Brilliant Dead. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, rolling into the movie reviews. Let's start things off with the big one, the new release this weekend. The only one that's really going wide that hasn't been out yet, that you haven't had a chance to see in other limited ways. Like, The Walk is going wide, but we already talked about that. And that was in its IMAX run, and now it's going into other theaters. But Pan is the only one that's getting the full-blown, brand-new release to all the cinemas out there. Kind of the way The Martian was last week. And this family fantasy tells the origin of Peter Pan from when he was an orphan in London during World War II.
Welcome to Neverland!
Be brave, Peter.
I try to be.
We have an ancient prophecy from when the fairy kingdoms reigned on this island. The prophecy tells of a boy who would lead an uprising against me. A boy who could fly.
You have to get us off this island.
We've been waiting for you, Peter.
Obviously, this is all made up. Well, obviously, all of Peter Pan is made up. I mean, it's a fictional story. But this is an extension of what the original James Barry play was. I mean, obviously, he didn't write a prequel. He didn't do, you know, Peter Pan, the prequel, like Leprechaun Origins. This is Peter Pan Begins. This is, we see this all the time, the prequel, essentially. And what it does is it shows where Pan came from. So it is sort of manufactured and it's created. Now it has this whole, and you really hear it in the trailer, it has this whole prophecy thing. I've never been a big fan of prophecy stories. I've never been a big fan of You're the Chosen One. And I recognize that some of my favorite movies follow that pattern. I mean, Star Wars is a great example. That one's the, you are the chosen one. You're the prophecy. You're going to bring balance to the force, blah, blah, blah. But I mean, that's not the driving force of it. It's an adventure and it just so happens to work out that way. I've never been a big fan of predestination in movies. I've never been a big fan of saying, oh, well, you are there's the chosen one. We all know you're going to make it. It's kind of a cheap technique. And so this does fall into that. And it also has some really embarrassing performances, partly from Hugh Jackman. He plays Blackbeard, who's the bad pirate who steals all the boys from the regular world and brings them to Neverland. And he really chews the scenery. You can hear him in the beginning of that trailer. He's really hamming it up. But at least Jackman understands how to ham it up and make it work. The real problem acting-wise is Garrett Hedlund. He plays James Hook. You don't hear him very well in the trailer, but he's like, I'm James Hook! Okay, well, here I am. I don't know. I mean, is he doing this sort of weird Christopher Lloyd impression? He is, or maybe he's doing Jack Nicholson from The Shining. Little Bigs, let me in. In the hands of a better actor, it would have been silly. I mean, and I've seen really good actors do this sort of thing. Gary Oldman in The Fifth Element had a ridiculous accent, but you could kind of forgive him because he's Gary Oldman. He can do a lot of crazy stuff. But Garrett Hedlund's never been accused of being a fantastic actor. And it comes off as really corny. I mean, maybe he was going for the theatrical side. And maybe if he was on stage, it would have worked. But in a movie, it's just camp all over the place. I was okay with him, but I'm just like, yeah, that's a big wart on this movie. But I'll tell you, I can't say I wasn't entertained. I enjoyed the heck out of this movie. I mean, all the warts aside, bad acting and sort of a trite storyline. It's a gorgeous looking movie. I mean, it looks fantastic. And everything Joe Wright, the director, everything he does looks fantastic. I mean, this is the guy who did Atonement and Pride and Prejudice. His stuff looks fantastic. And he's very much it's a scientific term, hoity-toity director. Because he does tend to get a little bit snobbish in his work. And this one just borderlines on that, but kind of in the way I remember when I was a kid and I'd go and visit my grandparents and it'd be right around Christmas and there'd always be Christmas specials on TV and they'd always find something on like PBS or something that was imported from Britain. And it was always something a little bit different than the normal fare you got just watching at home. And I always seemed to watch it at my grandparents. So there's a certain nostalgia factor there of these kids in an orphanage. And I mean, it feels like that kind of holiday movie that I would have watched as a kid, you know, when I was out of town for Christmas. So maybe that really helped me enjoy it. And I could look past the bad acting, but I mean, the special effects are amazing. The set design and the visual design is gorgeous. And it's kind of exciting. I mean, I tend to find Joe Wright's stuff kind of boring at times. I mean, I was just bored to tears with both Atonement and Pride and Prejudice. But this one moves. It runs about 2 hours, but it still works. I took my 7-year-old and he loved it. It was a lot of fun. It looks gorgeous in 3D. It's not a perfect movie, but if it would have been a November release, it would feel like a holiday release. It just feels like that. It doesn't feel like an October release. It doesn't feel like something you'd be releasing a couple weeks before Halloween, but who knows? Anyways, I gotta say, I enjoyed Pan. Warts and all, I enjoyed Pan. Isaiah kinda rocks.
It kinda rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about National Lampoon. Drunk, Stoned, Brilliant, Dead. This is the documentary which chronicles the rise and fall of the National Lampoon media empire.
After reading that first National Lampoon, I went, wow.
In those days, magazines were a bigger deal.
People defined themselves by the magazines they read.
Breasts. I would seek out the magazine on the off chance that there would be some breasts.
Tell me about National Lampoon. Why do you think it's so popular?
They're designed to flatter a particular audience of fairly well-to-do nobodies.
So there's this wonderful freedom.
If you don't buy this magazine, we'll kill this dog.
We can do anything we want!
For those who don't know how old I am, I was born in 1971. So when National Lampoon was in its heyday, I was way too young to even understand it. There's a bit in there where Kevin Bacon says, when he would read it, he'd be like, I just look for the breasts. You know, at some point they'd have naked women in it. And that's true. I remember at the newsstand with my dad and I'd grab National Lampoon because that's the one you could grab when you were a little kid. You can grab National Lampoon and they generally wouldn't snatch it from you. You grab the Penthouse, the person behind the counter would come and yell at you. You know, National Lampoon would sometimes have nudie pictures in it. And it was always satire, but when you're 10, you don't care about satire. I mean, it was way too sophisticated for me growing up. And by the time I would have enjoyed it, it was falling apart and on its way down. I do remember, of course, more than anything, the National Lampoon movies, which were stuff like Animal House, Vacation. It's an interesting look at the magazine, and it's an interesting look at comedy in the 60s and 70s and how it all gelled and how it sort of made this perfect storm that seeded stuff like Second City TV and it seeded Saturday Night Live. And everyone always thinks, oh yeah, you had the Groundlings, which fed into Saturday Night Live, or SCTV, which fed into Saturday Night Live. But these weren't farm teams that went to the big leagues. They were the steady state, and the people would work with each other and they'd slide back and forth between groups and everything. And then you see that stuff happening now, and that's how comedy works. Now, a lot of it's archaic. A lot of the stuff isn't as funny now as it was. I mean, back then it was very edgy. It was printed in a magazine. Magazines were a different world. Nowadays, you want to see something offensive, go online. A Google image search is going to get you plenty of offensive stuff. I can give you a string of search terms that'll melt your brain. But back in the 70s, it was kind of tough to find, especially at the newsstand. So this is a neat look at the controlled chaos that was the National Lampoon. But like I said, most of my growing up, I thought of National Lampoon as being the movie side of it. And yeah, you had the big ones, Vacation and Animal House. But then, I mean, you got Van Wilder, then the sequels to Van Wilder. National Lampoon is not a prestigious name to put on a movie at all anymore. And it was just barely that in the early 80s. National Lampoon as a movie entity is dirt. But the story behind the magazine is pretty fascinating. I'm going to say Drunk, Stoned, Brilliant, Dead kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for these reviews. Coming up next is He Named Me Malala and Peace Officer. There
There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kuykendall Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr, continuing with the movie reviews. I've got two documentaries I want to talk about, and you know, there are some people who really poo-poo documentaries, and I'm not saying that you need to have a steady stream of them, but there's a lot of interesting things to be said on screen in a narrative format in a documentary style. There's a lot of cool documentaries out there. There's enough diverse selection of documentaries. There's horror documentaries like Room 237 and The Nightmare, and there's comedy documentaries, and those a lot of times, you know, tied to a specific person, you know, like Michael Moore or Morgan Spurlock or just even whimsical things like American Movie. If you've never seen American Movie, that's a fantastic, amazing documentary about this guy in a train wreck of a film production up in Wisconsin. So I'm going to be looking at a couple documentaries in this segment. The first one is kind of a big release. It's getting a wide expansion. I think it's close to 500 theaters this week. And that is He Named Me Malala. This new documentary tells the story of Malala Yousafzai, the Pakistani teenager who was shot by the Taliban for trying to get an education.
Tonight, Malala remains in intensive care.
She was shot in the head for daring to suggest girls should go to school.
Me and my wife, we cried all the night.
They shot me on the left side of my head. They thought that the bullet would silence us. I am the same Malala.
I'm still 17. I'm still a teenager. My father said, have you forgiven them?
You've never felt angry?
No.
This is directed by Davis Guggenheim, who did movies like An Inconvenient Truth and Waiting for Superman. And I've never been a huge fan of his. I know I just went off on this big monologue on why you need to watch more documentaries. And then I'm going to give kind of a soft recommendation for this movie. And part of it's because of Guggenheim's work. I've never thought he's made particularly hard-hitting films. I think a lot of times in trying to make something interesting that maybe doesn't have as much content or at least the approach he takes, in particular like An Inconvenient Truth. I mean, this was a PowerPoint presentation. It was Al Gore giving a speech, which wasn't terribly interesting. He did the movie Waiting for Superman, which I take kind of personally because my wife's a teacher, and I know where there was a lot of sins of omission in that movie to really make a very specific political point that may not be as simple as he presented it to be. Now, in terms of He Named Me Malala, it's one of the big challenges of a documentary like this because everybody knows the story of Malala. If you're at all aware of international news events, you know this girl got shot, you knew she survived, and you knew what happens going forward. Now, if you haven't, go see the movie. It's kind of fascinating. But, you know, there's no suspense because you kind of already know the outcome. It's kind of like last week when I talked about The Walk, the original movie was based on is Man on Wire, is a documentary of Philippe Pettit's walk across the wire. And they got interviews with Philippe Pettit in the documentary. Well, you know he survives. There should be no question there, because if he's alive in 2008 to do the interview, he didn't fall to his death in 1974. There's a lot of talking heads in a movie like this, and it's very hard to do the narrative because there was no real documenting of her life, so to speak. There's no documenting of the incident where she got shot. So you have to reconstruct a lot of it. Now Guggenheim does some neat stuff with animation, where you see the story unfolding in abstract drawings, and that's very neat. But what I found most fascinating about this, because at a certain point, it's got to be a real challenge to be somebody like Malala, not just because you got shot in the face, but how do you live a normal life after that? You've reached your probably peak of international awareness, and you're still a teenager, and how do you then just go to school and go on dates and stuff like that? And so they look at that. They look at her family life, and they look at the adoration her father gives her, and they talk to her brothers, and that's got to be tough. Could you imagine being Malala's brother? I got an A on my math test. Your sister got shot in the face. I made the football team. Your sister won the Nobel Peace Prize. How do you top that? Talk about having somebody to live up to. What I found most interesting, when she's unfiltered, when she's just herself, because when, of course, she's in front of an audience, as anybody is, they go into speech mode. They go into, I do it too. If you get me in a media position or you get me on an interview, I'm very different than if I'm just sitting around having a beer with friends watching a movie. So it's an interesting enough film. It runs a little bit long, and it struggles to find what the actual story is because it's got so much content to deal with. But overall, He Named Me Malala kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next film I want to talk about is Peace Officer. It's a much smaller documentary. A retired sheriff who founded the SWAT team in his county works to fight against the militarization of police in America.
On the 22nd of September, 2008, the very SWAT team that I founded in the 1970s killed my son-in-law in my presence.
The police are creating these circumstances.
The premise that the cops are becoming more like the military, it is false.
Police officers are receiving military weapons and equipment. When you dress them up and you give them that mindset, it's not a surprise that they start acting in a militaristic way.
One of the things that I found most relevant about this movie is so many news stories recently that have involved the police in a negative light have involved race as well. This movie doesn't address that at all. All the people that are being victimized in the profiles are white people. Now, that's important because when you've got an issue of overreach of police authority or the militarization of police, and then you've got a racial issue, it's very easy to get confused. These are two totally separate issues that kind of mesh together. This isn't talking about that. This is talking about essentially the overuse of SWAT teams to deliver warrants that are not violent warrants, going in and storming houses, destroying personal property, and sometimes resulting in the death of one or more people who purportedly they're trying to save. Now, I am not at all making any sort of statement against the police here. I think the police make a great contribution to society, and what's happening here transcends just the actions of a specific officer. You're talking about training, and you're talking about a mindset of equipping the police, and that's what this movie shows. This movie shows the development of SWAT team, the history of a SWAT team, why they have the tools that they have, and why these tools may not be used in the most appropriate actions. And of course, they give both sides of the story. They give the police to defend it and say, well, no, we're just protecting ourselves. But I think what really is clear in this is the push to make more sections of the police more like soldiers. And there's a great shot in there of one of these things that these guys are, they got automatic weapons and body armor, and they're coming out of a Bearcat, which is an assault vehicle. And they're wearing camo pants. And I have to even, they wouldn't point this out in the movie, but I had to, what's the point of wearing camo pants? What's the point of wearing camo pants on delivering an arrest warrant in the suburbs? And this is the key point. It's not that a policeman is doing the wrong. It's that you're equipping them like soldiers. But there's a huge difference between a policeman and a soldier. The military and the police have two very different objectives. Now, it's very easy to say, oh, well, they're similar. There's a lot of connective tissue. I mean, they both are uniform. They both have weapons. They both have gadgets and utilities, and they both have authority, and they both at times have to use lethal force. But like a doctor and a lab tech, just because you're wearing a white coat and working in a room with a lot of medical equipment does not make you the same job. Just as you don't want your doctor to treat you like a lab rat, and just as you don't want a lab technician to treat a lab rat like a human patient. Very different objectives. The military's job is to kill people, destroy things, blow things up, to aggressively defend and assault. That's what a military does. That's its primary purpose. The police protect and serve. And just as you shouldn't have the American military going out around the world and being a police force, you shouldn't have the police equipped with this much hardware to serve an arrest warrant or to serve a search warrant to find $100 worth of pot in somebody's house. Just the policy and the way this works. And it's framed really well because the guy who runs this is the retired sheriff. He's very meticulous and he's very deliberate and he's very good at his job. And you see it from his eyes, not in a political way, but of saying, look, this is just not good policy. We need to evaluate this. And then they have the talking heads to talk about it, too. But Peace Officer is an eye-opening documentary and very balanced, I have to say. So I'm going to say Peace Officer totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Big Stone Gap. And I'm also going to be doing the box office and the DVD roundup. Elizabeth Stokes' new romance novel, Five Nights in Vegas, is about meeting, getting married, and falling in love, in that order. Lexi Frost is a cocktail waitress in a Las Vegas casino. Nate Zimmerman is a marketing executive from back east. After a chance meeting on Nate's business trip, they wake up to discover they got married at an all-night wedding chapel. During their whirlwind attempt to undo their mistake, Lexi and Nate discover they might just be made for each other after all. Five Nights in Vegas by Elizabeth Stokes is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, finishing up the show. Let's talk about Big Stone Gap. This is an independent film that's getting somewhat of a release, a couple hundred theaters around the country. It's opening in Columbus, Ohio, which is my hometown, and smaller communities, not just like New York and LA and Chicago. And I had a chance to talk with Paul Wilson, whose brother is Patrick Wilson, the actor. And he's involved in the film. He's got a small role in the film. His brother Patrick has a bigger role. The interesting part about Big Stone Gap is it's kind of this family project by the Wilson family, because they have a personal connection to not just the city of Big Stone Gap, Virginia, which is deep in coal mining country, but also to the author of the original novel, who also directs the movie. And Paul was involved in a lot of the production and in behind the scenes angle. So he had a chance to sit down and talk with me. I'm going to play you his interview and then I'll drop the trailer and talk about the movie. First, just tell me a little bit about the movie.
The movie itself, to me, is a story of love and a story of happiness. And it's a town called Big Stone Gap in Big Stone Gap, Virginia, you know, named after a best-selling novel called Big Stone Gap. And the movie itself, I think, is emblematic of a lot of small towns. While, you know, not everyone can relate to, you know, a small town, everyone can relate to their hometown. So this story is about home. And in this world that is kind of homogenized by the internet and the global community that the internet has created, we don't want to lose small town charm. And this is definitely a story of small town charm.
Did you film the entire thing in Big Stone Gap?
The entire movie was shot in Big Stone Gap, Virginia, a town that you could take the entire occupants and put them in a parking lot in most Walmarts. But everything, thanks to the state of Virginia, thanks to the stick-to-itiveness of the hometown girl, Adriana Trigiani, who wrote the novel that became a bestseller. She wanted to write, by the way, the movie first, and she did. And 14 years ago, she wanted to shoot it in the town, with the town. And now with modern filmmaking and the ability to kind of, you know, shoot for a much more affordable cost, we did. As we sat there in October of 2013 with her brilliant script that was character rich beyond anything I've ever read. Now we're here. So now the movie, I think, will resonate on multiple levels.
Now, you mentioned family being a big thing. Your brother Patrick has a major role in it. I've heard some other people who I know talk about this movie. They say it's a real family project for the Wilson. How did the Wilsons get involved?
For many, many years, my grandmother, that perhaps might be the only bittersweet moment about shooting this movie. For my grandmother not to be around, she passed away about 9 months prior to shooting. It was kind of a bittersweet moment, but my grandmother would tell us for years, have you seen what Adriana Trigiani is doing these days? And so my grandparents were friends with her parents, Adriana's parents. And she went to Hollywood and went to New York and was very successful. So we vicariously were following her career, and she tells the story. She had to wait for Jack Mack's character, which is played by Patrick, of course, to age, that is Patrick, to age into the character. And it actually kind of, in a providential way, fell in perfectly. But to be able to make a movie as an actor, that is myself, that, you know, has not done a lot, but had an opportunity to work with my brother and then stay on a road called Wilson Road in a house that was built for my father and occupied by my grandparents until, you know, about 9 months prior to our shooting, that was our Disneyland. And Big Stone Gap is something that we always treasured and cherished. But to be able to share it with the world and remind us all that however big we come from, there's heart there. Don't lose that. And this movie is definitely a story of heart. It's not typical Hollywood fare, you know, as you can see.
I was born and raised in Big Stone Gap. Before I knew it, it was 1978 and I turned 40. I was the old maid.
At this point, you just gotta take whatever you can get.
He was out last night, Sue Tinsley.
Come on, she's a catch.
Your mama came in to see me about doing her well. When people die, that's when old secrets come out.
This is my father. I like being the town spinster. It has cachet.
I have to say that sometimes I get a little bit nervous when something like this comes across my desk because there's a very personal connection. I one of the stations I have a radio relationship with is very connected to the Wilson family. And so I was able to get to see this movie early and, which normally they didn't screen it. It was a very small production. So they don't have a whole lot of money to spend on marketing. And I'm always nervous getting a film like this because what if I don't like it? And that's happened before, and it can be very awkward. Well, the other reason why I'm a little bit nervous about a movie like this is very wholesome. It's a very wholesome movie. And I remember when Paul emailed me about this, he was like, oh, the only four-letter word in it is love, which is corny. But, you know, that encapsulates what this movie is. And I'm afraid it's going to be like some crappy Hallmark movie. And it's not. And that's the thing. And it's a relief to see a movie like this and have it not be that. I mean, yeah, sure, it's corny. I mean, if you don't like corny, small town, nice movies, you're not gonna like this movie. If you need to have something horrific or action filled or contentious or a really dastardly villain, you're not gonna get it in this film. This is cut from that cloth of sitting down with the family and watching it. It's sort of like the Disney Sunday night movie that they used to have, or like my mother-in-law will watch, you know, these movies on the Hallmark Channel, you know, movies like Sarah Plain and Tall and Saving Sarah Kane and these kind of films. And they tend to also, this isn't a faith-based movie, although it does have a little bit of that wholesomeness to it that makes it feel like that. I'm always afraid that they're going to be terrible. And this one's not. And the reason it's not are two huge things, aside from the fact that it's an enjoyable script. It's well constructed and it doesn't get preachy, but the cast is actually pretty phenomenal. I mean, Ashley Judd plays the lead, and she's really sweet and charming, and she controls the movie, and she's very comfortable in it. And that's not always the case for her. But you also have people like Whoopi Goldberg's in it, Jane Krakowski, you've got Chris Sarandon shows up at one point. There's a whole group of people in here, and people like Ashley Judd and Patrick Wilson and even Whoopi Goldberg, even though she kind of plays sort of the comic relief at times. They're good actors, so they elevate the scripts a bit, and then it's also beautifully shot. It does not look like some crappy little Hallmark movie or something that's going to wreck the video. It looks like a full-blown professional film. It's shot competently. It's composed extremely well. It looks like something you can see in the theater. It's not like something like The Identical, which Ashley Judd was also in and terrible in. It's a sweet movie. Like I said, if you don't want something sweet and cute and charming, you're not going to like it. But this is the kind of thing you can sit down and watch with your grandmother. And so, yeah, I'm going to have to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk really quick about the box office. Last week, I predicted that The Martian was going to make $50 million, more than what a lot of people were saying. They were in the 40s. It actually almost made $55 million. It did better than $50 million. That's a huge win for Matt Damon and Ridley Scott and 20th Century Fox. This did very well. It also kind of opened up against no competition. There were no wide releases. And the only thing that was really in big competition with it was Hotel Transylvania 2. And that had a totally different demographic. So yeah, The Martian did very well. I think it's going to win again this weekend. I liked Pan. I thought Pan was charming. I really think it's going to struggle to get past 20 million. It's getting some pretty bad reviews by some people, I think, are unfairly being harsh on it because it's still a beautiful looking, fun movie. But for a movie like this, you need to have good reviews. For just some stupid comedy or a horror movie, you don't need good reviews. But sometimes for a movie like this, for something from Joe Wright, you should have good reviews. And if you're not getting good reviews, there's something wrong. So I think that's going to struggle. I don't think The Walk's going to do terribly well in wide release. It did very soft in its IMAX run and only made $1.5 million, which was a fraction of what Everest made in its IMAX run.
listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the world-famous DVD roundup. One I forgot to talk about last week was The Bear. And this is a 1988 French film about a bear cub that's orphaned and befriends a male grizzly, which normally eats a lone cub. The only time it kind of gets a little bit awkward is when they use a little bit of voiceover and ADR for the bears. And it sort of sounds like a human at times because they shot all this without sound and then added the sound later because it's just way too complex to be doing things with trained animals without being able to yell out commands. There's also Gravy, which I talked about last week in limited release. It's now available on DVD and Blu-ray. That's, of course, James Rohde's movie about these psychopaths who hold people hostage in a restaurant and then start to eat them, cannibalistic style. There's also Magic Mike XXL, which is not good, terrible. Just as bad, if not worse, than the first one. Me and Earl and the Dying Girl, which got a lot more accolades and then kind of fizzled in its release, mainly because it's a little bit derivative of other mopey, morose teen death dramas. Manglehorn, which stars Al Pacino, I reviewed that a couple months ago. Not terribly great. When Marnie Was There, that's another Studio Ghibli movie, a beautiful story. Beautifully animated, much more down to earth and not as fantastic as something like Howl's Moving Castle or Spirited Away or My Neighbor Totoro. On TV, you've got South Park Season 18. Can you believe it? Season 18 and now they're 19. And then American Horror Story Freak Show, just in time for Halloween. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Tales of Halloween, Bridge of Spies, Goosebumps, and Crimson Peak. We got some spooky movies next week, so tune in. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.